white supremacist organizations are actually a part of regular conversation in America today, after a stunning moment from Tuesday night's presidential debate.
You want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
Supremacists and
white supremacists and
white supremacists and right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
Researchers at the Harvard Kennedy School who track online hate groups like the Proud Boys say they've seen hundreds more people join since Tuesday night, including here in New England. Joining us now is Joan Donovan, research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School. Joan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. It's a shame I can't be in the studio.
I know. It would be great to see you in person. What has happened since the president refused to condemn white supremacy and used the phrase stand back and stand by at the debate?
For the militia groups and white supremacists online, they were obviously like everybody else watching the debates. So when they got a wink and a nod from the president, we saw an uptick in activity in groups that they were chattering in. And also they used the slogan to create a bunch of memes and even a T-shirt. And now they are embracing a new wave of media attention and really trying to drive their issue into public discussion. And mainly prior to this, the reason why that came up is because we saw these groups organizing, even though they had been removed from Facebook and Twitter in 2018, they were creeping back onto these platforms underneath the banner of Blue Lives Matter groups and Back the Blue campaigns.
Okay, you just said embracing new wave of media attention. So I want to pause for a second. Having done some homework this week on best practices in reporting on white supremacist groups, I want to ask, is it problematic that we have already said one group's name multiple times on our air already during this discussion? How should we think about that?
It's a really good question. And when a group like that gets a national stage, we end up really having to think twice about what it is that we say in public about them. And so one of the things that journalists should be really cognizant of is just not giving these people the microphone. You don't want to call up the Proud Boys and say, hey, why don't you tell me what your group represents? Which under normal circumstances for journalists is the first thing you would do.
So why don't you tell us about the Proud Boys, who they are, the wider ecosystem in which they operate?
So it goes back to 2016 and the initial wave of white supremacy that we were talking about back then, which was called the alt-right. The Proud Boys were a group that were looking to fashion themselves as similar but different. And so they posted a lot of jokey videos of themselves online, described themselves as a drinking club. And one of the main features was that people had to take an oath, which said, you know, similar things that we've heard from white supremacists, like, you know, I'm a proud male chauvinist and I won't apologize for inventing the modern world. And so there are a lot of jokey things about this group from 2016 that are still things that people think this group subscribes to. But over the last several years, this group has been at the forefront of some of the most violent political events in specifically the Pacific Northwest, and most recently were involved in a series of violent events related to these Trump caravans that were being organized, or these MAGA caravans, where groups would show up in Portland, you know, several dozen cars and trucks. In one such occasion, they had brought paintball guns and were shooting at protesters and other passersby. And so groups like this are known entities in different areas. But once they reach this sort of national stage, it becomes really important for people to understand that this is a violent organization that has ties both to militia groups and it does, you know, really subscribe to white supremacist ideologies.
So, Joan, I want to shift our focus here, both away from that organization and back towards home. You say that you've been seeing and tracking hundreds of people join these groups since the debate. I do think there is a misconception that this only happens in, say, Midwestern states, southern states, you just mentioned the Pacific Northwest, but this is something that's happening here in New England too, isn't it?
Yeah, so if anybody's been out to some of the protests, you've seen counter-protesters that are, you know, in support of these police, more broadly. And you'll see some of their T-shirts and ways in which they've organized around Back the Blue or Blue Lives Matter, which that on its surface is not a problem. But when you start to look at, well, what other things are they doing? Where else are they congregating online? You see that a group like Super Happy Fun America, which doesn't sound like what it is, has been at the in the background organizing what was the Straight Pride Parade a few months ago, and then also several rallies in Boston over the summer in support of police. But when you look at the pictures of those events, people are wearing open white nationalist paraphernalia and signals. And so we have to take seriously the fact that these groups see certain themes as opportunities to do a bit of a bait and switch, which is that, of course, yes, they do support the police, but that isn't the only feature that's bringing them together.
So I do want to point out two things. One, for listeners, you are not equating people who are pro-law enforcement with these white supremacy organizations. And two, Super Happy Fun, the last word always escapes my head, Super Happy
America.
Fun America, also organized the rally in 2017 over the summer where there was counter-protesting in Boston. Let's move on.
Yeah, and I want to reiterate, I don't think there's a problem with people in support of law enforcement and really trying to bridge the gaps in communities around communication. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is these groups are congregating under the cover of, and we saw this back in 2016 and 2015 at a number of Trump rallies. Known white supremacists were using the fact of the rally to openly advocate their positions in public.
So now, President Trump has since made an additional statement since Tuesday night saying, quote, "I don't know who the Proud Boys are. I can only say they have to stand down, let law enforcement do their work," unquote. I wanted to ask you how you read that. Is it a walk back, a disavowal? Is it actually similar to what he already said? What is your take?
In this situation, I think that we don't really know anybody's intentions, right? When or what Trump did or didn't know. But I think it's important that when he says let law enforcement do their job, it's because law enforcement are the ones who are reckoning with the militias that are showing up in the streets, the armed white vigilante groups that are showing up in the streets. And what's telling about it is the statement that Trump made. He talked about the Proud Boys, and then in the next breath, he talked about anti-fascist protesters and the violence on the left. And this has been a particular focus of the Proud Boys. One of the reasons why they were deplatformed by Facebook and Twitter in 2018 is because they would call for public rallies, and when they would go out, there would be anti-fascist protesters would come out in reaction. And Proud Boys weren't just showing up to these rallies and then a skirmish broke out. They were showing up with weapons. They were showing up both with clubs and other kinds of knives and also pepper spray. And when you look at the footage of these events, it's just a rolling street brawl. And so it becomes really dangerous for police to have to deal with dynamics like that where people are armed.
So I want to ask this next question thoughtfully, which you talked about the president immediately pivoting to talk about left-wing extremism. He said it's the real problem on Tuesday night. He has repeatedly argued when pushed on white supremacy organizations that Antifa is the true threat. I want to clarify, at the beginning of this year, the FBI placed racially violent extremists, the majority of which it has said are, quote, fueled by some kind of white supremacy, unquote, on par with foreign terror organizations. And last month, FBI Director Christopher Wray testified that Antifa is an ideology, not an organization. Nevertheless, we hear people talking about concern about the presence of Antifa at protests as well. Despite those facts that I just laid out, is it appropriate to argue some equivalence between these kinds of groups?
It's a difficult question because we wouldn't ask the same thing about, you know, feminism. Nobody's saying, well, who's the organizer of feminism,
right,
and who's behind it? You actually have to think about the local and specific and contingent situations that protests arise in. And so we will see we will see protests become violent for different reasons in different cities. And in cities that have a local anarchist contingent of folks that are, you know, going to many different kinds of protests, not just recent ones, but have been doing it for many years, the police have a way of approaching them and have a way of working with groups like that. Right now, over the summer, we've seen a bunch of people, just people that are not really well organized, that are going out into the streets for various reasons. And whatever kicks off the violence in those areas is often, when you talk to activists or business people in the local area, a lot of it has to do with local dynamics and the ways in which those protests are being handled. And so if we look back into July, when federal agents were showing up in unmarked cars and arresting people in the Pacific Northwest, and you heard activists saying, we don't know what's going on, our people are being disappeared, that adds to a kind of tension that is more likely going to end in violence, because people are not able to assess the threats that are being made against them. And we do see then those areas start to turn into, you know, there starts to be really difficult relationships between the police, the federal government, and local protesters. But it's really hard to say, because on the flip side with the right wing violence, you'll see in their chat rooms, you'll see in their groups that they will talk about what weapons they're going to bring. They'll talk about how much they can't wait to get their hands on, you know, these protesters. They'll talk by name about protesters that they want to assault. And so that kind of fora and where they're openly talking about it is where we have more evidence of the actual coordination of violence.
So, in listening to you, so some groups are specifically threatening armed violence if they believe the election is fraudulent. On Tuesday night, we heard President Trump invoke his supporters or exhort his supporters to go to the polls to watch what is going on. The president has also repeatedly said that the election likely will be fraudulent, even though there's no evidence for that. It sounds like we should not just take all of that as trolling. It sounds like you think there is reason to take it quite seriously. Is that right?
We are in such a specific situation that it's really hard to even assess what's going to happen tomorrow. But we know pretty confidently that on November 3rd, we are not going to have a victor, which is to say that it's going to take a while for votes to be counted. There's, I believe, 8 states that can't even open mail-in ballots until the November 3rd as the election day. And so that interim period where we are waiting for the votes to be counted and cast is going to be a very historically significant time where there's going to be a lot of anxiety and fear. And what we know about disinformation is it really parasitically attaches itself to fear and outrage. And so I'm very concerned that calls for public action and the current situation that we're in, where people are showing up armed and in some ways playing the role of police in their communities, is going to be lead to violence in different areas. And the last thing I'll say about this is also about the end of the debate, where Trump called for people to be poll watchers. Not a lot of people know what the process around poll watching is, but you can't actually just go to a poll and hang out a polling station and hang out and watch what's happening and ask people about the ballots and things. You actually, if you are involved in a campaign, there's a process by which people can become poll watchers. And if you are canvassing, you have to be a certain amount of feet from the front door of any polling station. But I have a feeling that when people find that out, which is the truth, they're going to feel as if somehow their rights are being trampled on and we're going to get into a very difficult situation.
And that is Joan Donovan, Research Director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. Joan, thanks.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.